Well, good morning.
Good morning.
So a number of you are already puzzled and have asked me about blank sheets of paper, and then you have an awfully weird title there up on the screen. We'll get to that. It's actually not as complicated as you might think. Today, next week, we kind of have an interlude between a series. Pastor Greg is filling pulpit for Ted Clark, who's pastor at Radisson Road Baptist Church today. So he was out of town, and so he's preaching there today. Originally, he was going to have his series finish today, and then I was going to do just kind of a single day topic next Sunday on Labor Day weekend, and then we'll start a series on the doctrine of sin here coming up after Labor Day weekend. But with him being away, we've got 2 weeks, and I've always got kind of a few topics rolling around in my head that I'd like to talk about at some point, and this is one of them. And so we've just got this week and next week to talk about this idea. What's probably more important to you is that subtitle, What Has Changed in Our World. So this week and next week, we'll talk about what has changed in how we view the world. What has fundamentally changed in the way in which people in societies like America and most Western countries, what has changed in how they view the world. Now, I'm just going to forewarn you that today I'm not going to talk about the Bible at all. We will do that next week. We're just going to lay some foundations this week. So it's a little unusual for our Sunday school time, but we just want to analyze for a little bit about how people think and what has changed. So next week, we'll use some scripture to help us think about this topic. But even that, I'll just be honest, is going to be fairly limited. Now, as we begin, I think everybody in this room understands, at least intellectually, if not they feel it in their soul, that something in our world has changed, fundamentally changed, in the way that people view the world, and especially that has come to bear in society as a whole over the last 40 years. So if you're maybe 35 or older, you recognize this because you have actually seen it happen before your eyes, even if you don't have the categories to actually describe it. If you're younger than that, you have essentially grown up in a different world than the people who were born about 40 years ago. It is just fundamentally different in the way people see things and think about things. And I'll even use this term, even feel things. It's fundamentally changed. Something has changed in our society, and not just in American society, but in Western civilization, Western societies as a whole. Now, certainly, people in their 50s or above, we have recognized the surface changes around us. I'll reference this book a little bit later. This book is called The Rise and Triumph of the Modern Self by Carl Truman. He's a Presbyterian pastor and teacher. He's a good guy, gospel preaching man. Enjoy just about everything that he writes, as long as it's not a baptism and church structure. Everything else is really, really good. Carl Truman has... In the introduction to that book, he begins it by saying, asking a question. He says, my grandfather, he asked, would he have understood this statement? And Truman is probably, I'd guess, in his late 50s at this point. He said, would my grandfather have understood this statement? I'm a man trapped in a woman's body, or I'm a woman trapped in a man's body. So for those of you in your 50s or older, would your grandparents even have a clue as to what in the world that would mean?
I still don't know.
Yeah, somebody said, I still don't know, right? But at least it seems, it doesn't to us as Christians, but it's normal to hear people talk that way now, right? So that's actually a surface, it's a significant change, but it's a surface level change. What we want to actually talk about here this week and next week is what's underneath some of that that has brought that kind of change. And I don't just mean in the transgender thing. I'm just talking about the way people perceive the world. What has fundamentally changed? Now, today, we live in an era that is described by expressive individualism. And I'm going to promise you that that first phrase, metaphysical dream, the second phrase, expressive individualism, and I'll use a third phrase at the very end of our time, they're the most complicated phrases we're going to use, okay? So don't think if you saw this title like, oh my goodness, this is going to like, you know, bore me to tears, or it's going to be so confusing I won't be able to grasp it. I actually think you'll be able to understand it pretty easily. We live in an era described by expressive individualism. In fact, if you've listened to my preaching, I have actually used that phrase on occasion and will, if I actually preach my notes today, I'll actually use it in this morning's service as well. Okay. It is not original with me, but in many ways it defines our current world. The phrase was first invented and used by the American scholar Robert Bella. And he defined it and described it this way. He said, expressive individualism holds that each person has a unique core of feeling and intuition that should unfold or be expressed if individuality is to be realized. All right? So he says, he used this phrase, that each person, so every person, has a unique core of feeling and intuition that should unfold. It should be expressed if who you are as an individual is to be realized, or we could actually even use the word actualized. All right? Now let me just ask you, is that what we see in our world today? Oh yeah. This is everywhere. Robert Bella coined this term in 1996. He was looking at American and Western society, and he said already in the 90s, something has changed. And this is how he described it. Similarly, the Canadian philosopher Charles Taylor, he speaks of what he called the culture of authenticity. The culture of authenticity. And he says the culture of authenticity says that each one of us has his or her own way of realizing our humanity, and that it is important to find and live out one's own, that is, one's own way of humanity, as against surrendering to conformity with a model imposed on us from outside by society, by previous generations, or religious or political authority. Would you say that we see just a little bit of that in our world today? Again, it's everywhere. Taylor wrote this in his book, A Secular Age, in 2007. Now, these two men, to my knowledge, are not Christians, at least not in the biblical sense of what we think about as a born-again, Bible-believing Christian. But they have rightly described something that has happened in our world. And so Carl Truman, not in this book, but in a shorter work called Strange New World, and that's a book, by the way, that is going to be in our library soon, as well as his Rise and Triumph of the Modern Self. Strange New World is a fairly easy read that really helps you to understand what's going on today. Also, Brett Williams recommended that book when he did his conference as well. It deals with some of these broader issues. But he says this, he says, and as he thinks about these two men and others like him, he says, in short, the modern self is where authenticity is achieved by acting outwardly in accordance with one's inward feelings. Okay? Now, the key to these statements is that there is something that's on the inside of us that is projected outward to define our reality. That's what they're suggesting in all of these. There's something inside of us that's projected, that is expressed, that is brought to bear on the world around us that defines our world according to ourselves. So let me just highlight again some of the words these men use to describe this. Things like feelings, or our own way of realizing humanity, or the core of feeling and intuition. These things exist in us, and they're pushed out to the world to bring to bear ourselves upon the world. In fact, I'm going to suggest today that actually the way most people think is that's actually how they define their world, is by what's inside projected to the outside. Now, my guess is that for those of you who maybe are in your late 60s, 70s, or older, that you probably at least recognize this in our world around us, but you all immediately think about things like that, like, that's insane, right? That's absolutely crazy. And part of the reason for that is, by and large, you didn't grow up in a world in which this was the air in which you breathed. For those of you who are, say, let's say 35 to 60, you still may think it's crazy, but in some sense, we kind of shrug our shoulders and say, and so, I mean, this is what we've grown up with. This is what I've grown up with. I've been taught this, not from the church, not from my parents, but it's literally been taught at every cultural institution that for my entire existence, right? These ideas. Right, you know, like I think about this. I played flag football, first, second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth grade for a local YMCA. And on the back of all of our shirts, every single year, there were different phrases for different teams, but they were the same, and you would see them. One of the phrases is like a trope now. It literally said, "Every kid's a winner." All right, every kid's a winner. And the second one is, you know, what counts is what's on the inside. All right, that's what I grew up with as a kid. Okay, to a certain degree, even Mr. Rogers taught me that, didn't he? You know, everybody's different, everybody's fine, right? You know, this was ingrained into my entire existence growing up. Now, if you're under the age of 35, you may have been taught well to think this is wrong, but you probably don't recognize how much this has affected you. I'm old enough to see the kind of the transition happening in our society, you know, and my parents were griping about it, okay? But now, today's parents often don't say anything to their children about it, because it's just the world that they live in. Something has fundamentally changed. And what we're talking about here is actually something very new in the realm of human thinking. It's a new idea that what is inside of us in terms of our feelings and intuition should be expressed outwardly as something that defines our existence. So what I want to do this week and next week is to briefly, and I mean very briefly, is to give you a sense of how we have got there as a society and what has changed along the way. I'm borrowing a lot of brains here, and this is a really brief overview and summary on these issues to do this. This is a book I read a number of years ago by Richard Weaver entitled Ideas Have Consequences. I'll just say this is not an easy read. It is a worthwhile read. He's the one that coined the phrase metaphysical dream, and I'll talk about what that is in just a moment. Another important book, a little bit older, but C.S. Lewis, in some sense, was a prophet. He saw this coming. It's in his book, Abolition of Man. Again, this is not an easy read. The words are simple, but you should plan to read this short book about three times, and you'll then like start to click what he's saying. So I will recommend one that's much easier to read. This book, as I mentioned earlier, The Rise and Triumph of the Modern Self by Carl Truman, is a tremendous book. He really does a lot of historical digging to show what has changed in our society from roughly the 1600s on. This is not as easy of a read. He delves into some philosophers. His shorter work, as I mentioned earlier, Strange New World, which I left at my house, otherwise I would have brought it over here and showed you a copy of it. That's actually a fairly, very easy read, and he kind of just summarizes what's in that larger book, and you would find that very profitable if you want to understand our world today. I also want to give credit to an important teacher in my life, Kevin Bowder, who's not only taught me these things in the classroom, but has written extensively. He has about a 60-page paper on called The Moral Imagination. And I'm just going to say I'm going to steal some stuff right out of that. So if you, I want to give credit where credit is due on some of these things. So what I'm talking about today and next week is like a very brief summary of some of these ideas. Yes, sir.
Can you summarize this whole thing in four words? There are no standards.
Yes, but the question is why? That's what we want to talk about. How do we get there?
I was going to say because it's easier.
There's something actually bigger that happened. It is easier. In one sense, it's actually painful. Our world is in more pain today. People are more depressed, more sad than ever. So it's actually harder. They just don't see it as such. All right, so we're my goal in talking about this is really focused on two areas. First, for some of you, you might wonder how in the world this has happened or even what has changed. And second, I want us to think in proper categories about our world today. And if you get what I'm going to say, and not really what I'm going to say, I've told you I'm borrowing from other people here, I think you'll see this everywhere, and it will help you as a Christian to guard your mind from this and guard your life. That's really my goal. So we're just thinking, what we're going to do is kind of like what Paul talks about, Corinthians, where he says, casting down imaginations and everything that exalts itself against the knowledge of God. We're going to do a little casting down over this week and next week. That's kind of what we're focusing on. Now, to do this, we're going to start by considering a little bit of philosophy, And I assure you that I'm not going to talk as a philosopher who speaks in what feels like sometimes as gibberish, but I think it will help us a great deal. Now, as we start thinking about philosophy, and yes, there is blank sheets of paper. We are going to get to those in just a moment, all right? We start with two problems that human beings have thought about for thousands of years. Human beings have wrestled with these two problems for thousands of years. You don't have to be a Christian to wrestle through these problems and to observe them. You just have to be a thoughtful human being. And some thoughtful human beings have thought a whole lot more about this than others, but it doesn't take long, and we recognize this to be an issue. The first problem is that everyone recognizes that we have massive amounts of immigration that information. We do have massive amounts of immigration, right? That was last Sunday night's topic, right? The first problem is that everyone recognizes that we have massive amounts of information that floods our minds that we know exists, but that our minds don't actually register as existing. All right, so everybody's got a piece of paper, and get ready. You've got a pen, or you can do this on your phone, or if you want to create notes or whatever. Here's what I want you to do. For the next 2 minutes, and I'm borrowing this exercise from somebody else, you got 2 minutes to write down everything you can see in this room. And go. You're halfway there. Have you got them all yet? Just a few more seconds. And time. All right. You all start just shouting out some things that you see.
Pastor Dave.
18 windows. Is that correct?
I'm counting doors, too.
Wow.
Okay.
Counting doors and each window.
Did you count one of the doors?
Yeah, he did. He said he counted the doors. Did you count the double doors over there?
Yes. Okay. I might have gotten one or two off, give or take.
All right. 18 windows. All right. Interesting. What else we got?
You. Outside view.
We got me? What?
Outside view.
Okay. View the outside. All right.
Speakers.
Speakers.
Piano.
Piano.
Screen.
Tables, chairs, mics, screen.
Sippy cup.
Light.
Fire extinguisher.
Fire extinguisher. Coffee pot.
Tea.
Safe.
Light.
Three lines of cream.
Mics.
Different creamers. Shoes.
Tables.
Ceiling tile.
Ceiling tiles.
Garbage cans.
Okay, so we got a lot of stuff, right? Now, you know the answer to this question. Have we collectively, even if we compared all of our list, actually described everything that we see in this room?
No.
Not even remotely close. In fact, even when we think about the windows, Tim was already doing something where he was having to decide what was counted as a window or not. All right, so he made a distinction in that I think you said you counted each one of these as separate. Of course, some of you might look at that and say that's one. And whether the doors counted as windows to the other classrooms. But some of you even mentioned the ceiling tiles. I mean, we could do the work of actually counting them to know how many ceiling tiles there are. How about something as simple as, well, there's the walls. But have you ever noticed that on the walls that there are smudges and dents and chips?
Outlet fixtures.
All right. Yeah, outlet fixtures. You look down at the carpet, you recognize that, you know, there are lines in the carpet, and the grain is going a certain way. There are lines that are going other ways. Now, when we walked into this room, we didn't actually consider each one of those things. We don't do that in any room. The closest you might come to is, let's imagine, I just saw that somebody the other day posted on X a series of some of the greatest and most beautiful libraries in the world. And I'd been to one of them on the list. If you go to the Iowa State Capitol, it has an absolutely gorgeous library and is listed in this list as one of the most beautiful in the world. I highly recommend it. Everything else about Iowa, you can leave. But that was great. Well, that's right. Josh is down there. Okay, we yes. But you left him anyways, so I'm just saying, all right?
I said fate.
Maybe in a place like that, you know, if you've ever been into a truly amazing room or building that you just stop and you stare. But even in that, you're not actually perceiving all of what's coming at you. You're filtering things out. So here's our first problem. We as a human beings have massive amounts of data that floods upon us, but we don't register it all. So human beings have noted, and these are two key terms, probably should have put them on the board, but I didn't, that there's a distinction between our sensation and our perception. What we sense is not the same as what we perceive. And of course, we only dealt with one of the five senses, right? You also have not only to see, but to touch and taste and smell and hear. And so if we started actually having to describe all of those things that we're experiencing in this room right now, you recognize that our mind is filtering through all of these things and only perceiving certain things. Huge amount of data, what we sense, but what our minds perceive is very, very limited. And by the way, in general, we should be thankful for that. I mean, anybody have enough, a hard enough time juggling with all the things that your mind perceives as it is right now? Right? I mean, I'm up here talking. By the time that we're done, you will probably, at best, hear 15% of what I say. You have a hard enough time focusing on me or whoever else is talking in front of you. Your mind is like, it's racing through this data. And it's like, with tons of it, just automatically saying, nope, don't think about that, all the time. That's a problem that human beings have noted for a long, long time. How do we account for this distinction between sensation and perception? What it means is that our minds have some sort of grids. They have a grid that begins to filter out some of our sensation, with the result that we perceive some things out of the flood of things that come to us. Now, here's a second problem that's related to the first, and that's this. We recognize that we have our minds, and we have the world, which is full of events and objects. We have our minds, and the world is full of events and objects. And so how does our mind actually relate to the world? Can we know with our minds what is actually real in the world? And if you say, of course we can, duh, just common sense. And a smart philosopher, or in fact a not so smart philosopher, is going to stop you and say, says who? How do you know that? For one thing, we've already just admitted that our minds as human beings filters out all sorts of events and objects in the world all the time. So are you, a philosopher is going to say and ask, are you right now actually perceiving reality fully? And if you say, I am, then I would just point out, have you perceived everything in this room in a moment? And the philosopher is going to say, you may not actually know what is really real. I have to say, oh man, that sounds like some, you know, recent gibberish garbage. Actually, no. All you need to do is go read Plato. From like, you know, like the Plato, not like the Play-Doh, Plato, you know, that guy. They existed before the time of Jesus, you know, ancient Greece. He was wrestling with these questions. Furthermore, how do you know that actually what's in your mind is not all a dream? Anybody ever seen the movie The Matrix or Inception? I mean, these are things that actually people have wrestled with for a long, long time. And humanity, over the last roughly 2,500 years, 3,000 years in that range, has essentially given one of three answers to that. And it's divided up over time. There's a pre-modern answer, there's a modern answer, and today we have a post-modern answer. And that's what we want to talk about this week and next week. How have people changed and how they begin to wrestle with those problems? Okay, let me illustrate this a little bit. We're going to start by talking about pre-modern man. And here he is, all right? Pre-modern man has a view of the world. And when I say pre-modern, we're talking about roughly people who lived before the 1700s. For those of you who know your history or even just a tab of philosophy, this is before the age of the Enlightenment. Pre-modern man, right? Even by the time you get to somebody like Martin Luther, he's already dabbling on the edges of modernity, which we'll talk about next week. Pre-modern man. For pre-modern man, he has thoughts, like all of us. He recognizes that his mind has thoughts. But he says something about the world. The world is ordered. The world around him is ordered. He looks at the events and the objects of the world, and he says that these events and objects are not random. They're not contingent. Everything in the world is connected to everything else. In fact, pre-modern man would describe the world in terms of God's transcendence But it's also, which we'll get to in a second, it's also in a real sense a universe. There are universals that govern the world. So everything's connected to each other, everything, and there is a real order to the world. That's the way that he looks at the world. All right? If you want to see a really simple contrast to that, and I promise I'm not going to do tons of movie references all day, but anybody ever seen the original Jurassic Park? Remember the doctor who's flying on the helicopter as they're going to the island, and he takes the girl's hand or the lady's hand and he puts water on it, and he talks about chaos theory and how you can't predict where anything's going to go, right? That's a non-ordered world. Pre-modern man didn't think like that. Everything had order to it. The universe is moral, or the universe, excuse me, is ordered. The universe is also transcendent. Transcendent. The universe begins by existing first in the mind of God. So God has an idea. And in fact, the way pre-modern man thought is that idea was fixed in God's mind, and what we see in reality here is a copy of what is in the mind of God. God has ideas. What we experience is a copy of what is actually real. They would distinguish between what we would call transcendent reality, it's the world of God, and immanent reality, what we see, touch, taste, smell, and so on, experience in terms of events and objects. They would also say, pre-modern man would also say, and I mentioned this a moment ago, I got ahead of myself, the world is moral. There is a moral order that first exists in the mind of God, but is also experienced in the world around us. And that moral order includes things that we can't even fully define, but we know that they exist, such as courage, liberty, compassion, freedom. And what the pre-modern person would have said is that you can find those things like courage over here and freedom over here and compassion over here in the world as we see it, as we perceive it, but that is ultimately a reflection of God's order that he has imposed upon the world. Morality stems from what God thinks as he has placed it into this world. God is not inventing morality, but it is an expression of the moral order that he himself is and has created.
Okay, well, you said it was in the mind of God. Couldn't you say it's in his nature?
Now, I would be absolutely fine saying that. They're almost impossible to distinguish. Now, in order to understand the world, oh, I should hear it say the moral, there's the idea of the moral world, that there are moralities that cut across this universe that we experience. Now, in order to understand the world, pre-modern man would have said that you need something to understand the world, both the immanent world, full of events and objects, and in order to understand the transcendent world, you need divine revelation. You need someone who actually understands everything to tell you how the world actually is. And what we mean by that is what the objects and events mean as they're connected to each other, and the moral realities of the world. Somebody has to tell you that. And so we need a revelation that comes from God to man. In this, what comes through God's revelation, we learn about two ideas of truth. The first idea of truth is with a lowercase t, and it has to do with propositions. Propositions are true or not true, whether they correspond with reality or not. A true proposition for pre-modern man needed to not only correspond with immanent reality, but also transcendent reality. But then also pre-modern man would have thought about truth with a capital T. There is a truth that we can understand and perceive. And ultimately, and I should have put this on my slideshow, ultimately we want this truth, as God sees it, to be in our minds. For pre-modern man, and again, think like pre-Enlightenment, so before the 1700s, largely, he believed that there was such a thing as the truth, and the truth existed in the mind of God, and as Joe has said, stemming from the character, the nature of God. And that if you wanted to know the truth which helped us make sense of all the things in the world, you needed to look to God. And this phrase is not original with me, and so pre-modern man would say, really, that the truth is up there. That's where you find real truth. And anything that we say about this world, what is true, the lowercase t, if it's really true, will match with the truth. They're not distinct. We might think of this, and I'm borrowing this analogy as well. In fact, I probably should just stop saying that. I told you, I'm borrowing everything from all these people, okay? We might think of this as something like, imagine that you're in a really large city, like a take New York City, Chicago, something like that, and you're downtown, and make sure it's a city with a river in it, because cities with rivers in it mess up the streets of a city, right? Because nothing's straight. Eventually you got roads that go at angles and they cross and all that stuff. You've never been to that city before. The city has all sorts of roads and you're in a little car, right? And you have an idea of where you want to go, but what do you really need if you want to get to where you need to go? What do you have to have?
Maps.
Got to have a map. Or today we would say GPS, right? You need a phone, right? Okay. We need a map. We need something that actually tells us about the way the city actually works. And pre-modern man says, yes, God has given us that so that we can understand the world around us. Now, this is, and I promise this is the last phrase today that we'll talk about that's big, but this idea is known as philosophical realism. You don't have to be a Christian to believe in this idea. Plato was not a Christian, but he did think that the realm of the gods gave order to the world. You can be an Islamist and believe this at its core. And certainly Christianity, in its origin, saw the world in this way. Now, we can ask a really, really simple question. Is this how our society views the world today?
Depends on who you are.
Yeah. But even on that, it's a really small number of people, right? This is not how our society thinks today. Something has changed. And we're going to talk about that next week because I'm out of time. We're going to talk about modern man and then then postmodern man. All right. I want to leave time for any questions about this so far. Any questions that you have? Joe.
So, when you say truth, little truth, little, and then capital truth, Are you doing that because ultimately you know that Christ is the way, the truth, the life, and so you're trying to distinguish other truth from that truth, but can you?
No, I wouldn't put it in those categories. Little truth is what we say about the world. The sky is blue. That's a proposition. We're proposing an idea. Okay? We say that about the world. If it is really true, if it is a true truth, it will correspond with the way God views the world. All right, now, that's pretty easy to understand, but what about this? The soldier who gives his life in battle for his fellow man is honorable. That's a proposition as well. That's a moral proposition, as I'm illustrating it this way. Is that true? If it's really true, if it's true truth, it will correspond in the way that God thinks. Which, by the way, I think, generally speaking, that's true. Both in its the way that we view the world morally in its order and in the mind of God. That's an honorable or a noble thing. That's how I'm making the distinction. Now, Jesus Christ is ultimately the perfect expression of this truth, and he lived in this world with all of the true truths. But fundamentally, I'm actually saying something different, is that this truth here is about what we say about the world. If it is really true according to the pre-modern man, it will correspond with the truth in the mind of God.
So, and that's what I'm trying to say is, I don't know how you can, if they're both truth, how you separate them from who Christ is.
I wouldn't have a problem saying that, but I'm trying to distinguish here at this point to say, people not named Christians would have thought in these categories in pre-modern man. So C.S. Lewis, in his book, Abolition of Man, does this as he takes time to consider the Chinese philosophy, ancient Chinese philosophy. It said very similar things. Doesn't mean, by the way, that that's the truth, but at least thought in those categories.
Is that a question?
Yes.
Did the pre-modern, the average pre-modern man, even have access to the real truth? I mean, did he have access to the real word? Pre-modern man before 1700.
Okay, so the question is, did the pre-modern man here have access to the real truth or the real word? Well, I would say that you're first of all thinking primarily in Christian categories. And the answer is, in a limited sense, yes. But they still would have thought in terms of God or the gods or some divine power as having a sense of what is ultimately real.
So what you're actually going towards in this is man is basically taking away the capital truth and replacing it with truth as the capital truth.
Sort of. You're on the right track. But I'll tease that out more. Before we get to there, we need to get through modernity, which we'll talk about next week. Okay, just in general, I'm just asking for honest feedback here. Can you consume this? Does this make sense? You follow this? Okay, I'm seeing a lot of heads nodding, so either you just want to help my self-esteem, or you're just like, I just hope this guy will shut up so we can go. So one of the two, all right? Or maybe you're just generally kind and you're telling me the truth. All right. With that said, we'll be dismissed, and then we'll come back next week and we'll think about this in terms of modernity and postmodernity. Thank you so much.